For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, keeping democracy alive even as conservatives try to pull a plug and sell off the body parts. Alive and well. Here we are. Boy, they're carrying off pieces of the studio in the as we're moving out to Oregon, as I've mentioned, on Friday. And so notice a faint echo in here. It's because all the sound baffling is gone. That's it. Anyway, John Cornyn, Senator John Cornyn, kind of put his foot in his mouth. And we're going to get to that. That's the low-hanging fruit. You know, that's the thing. Everybody's going to be outraged about it. And, of course, you want to call your member of the United States Senate. This is a senator. 1-877, toll-free, 1-877-SOB-U-SOB. The letter U, S-O-B-U-S-O-B. That's the toll-free number for the United States Senate, as well as the House of Representatives in the White House. And simply ask for your senator and register your concern that Senator John Cornyn should be censured for basically suggesting that it's okay to attack, harass, kill, throw bombs at, whatever, federal judges. Now, obviously, he didn't use that exact language. But I want to move that back, frankly, to the second hour of the program, because, as I said, it's, in my opinion, it's the low-hanging fruit of the day. And so, you know, I'll note it. But I think that there are some things happening that are going to have a whole lot more impact on your life and mine and the lives of our children and grandchildren right now that need to be talked about than whether or not John Cornyn has made a fool of himself, which he clearly has, and something needs to be done about. And here we have, for example, Don Lambro wrote a piece in the Washington Times. Now, of course, it's the Washington Times. It's the official Mooney newspaper. Reverend Moon owns it. It's the only newspaper that George W. Bush will read. Reverend Moon, of course, the guy that bailed Jerry Falwell out when he was $300 million in debt, the guy who has been proclaimed Messiah in the Senate office building. Pretty strange stuff. Anyhow, Reverend Moon's Washington Times, Donald Lambro, he writes, "The Democrats' post-election war about what they should stand for is heating up again." And this, I think, is really one of the very, very most important issues that we're going to be facing, and that is, what is the Democratic Party going to stand for? What direction are they going to go? What has happened is the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, this is the group that was founded around 1990 by Bill Clinton and a bunch of his friends. And you know, to give them credit, they founded this thing because they looked around and they said, hey, the Republicans are in the pockets of the big corporate interests. The Democrats traditionally have gotten their funding from trial lawyers and from unions, mostly from unions, and from having a strong on-the-ground machine, you know, Mayor Daley's machine, LaGuardia's machine in New York, that sort of thing, the urban machines. And the urban machines are dying, the urban areas are dying, and the unions have been under absolute direct assault by the Republicans ever since 1947, when they passed the Taft-Hartley Act and really picked up steam under Reagan when he declared war on organized labor and working people in the United States, and, you know, busting up PATCO and starting to stack the National Labor Relations Board and the Department of Labor with anti-labor people, something that has continued pretty much nonstop, a brief interruption during part of the Clinton administration, but largely continued nonstop ever since, and is just dramatically picking up steam now. And so, you know, Clinton looked around, and not just Clinton. I mean, some of these Democrats looked around, and they said, you know, we've got to have money to win elections. In 1978, the Supreme Court said that money is the same thing as speech, and corporations are persons, and they're entitled to free speech. This in the Boston versus Bilotti decision before the Supreme Court. This was 2 years before Reagan's election. And therefore, all his corporate money can pour in. And this, of course, was before John McCain got horrified by this and Russ Feingold, and they started trying to pass legislation to reform campaign financing. They still haven't got it right. I mean, it's just it's like trying to herd cats. You know, it's like trying to hold back the ocean with your hands. But in any case, because once the Supreme Court opened that door, which they shouldn't have done, by the way, I agree oddly, and I find this very weird, but I agree with Rehnquist, who wrote the lead dissent in the Boston versus Bilotti case. He said this is wrong. I'm paraphrasing, of course. He said back in 1886, this court, without benefit of discussion or debate, declared that corporations are persons and entitled to human rights under the Constitution. He says that's wrong. Corporations aren't persons. They're the creatures of law, and they shouldn't have the right of free speech. They shouldn't have political. They can't vote. What are they doing involved in politics? I agree. I agree with. The words choke in my throat. I agree with Rehnquist on this in his dissent in the Boston versus Bilotti case. But anyhow, what had happened was because of this law, this case, and a few other ones that also had this sort of impact. The Democrats looked around and they said, what are we going to do? We've got to have enough money to win an election because basically, you know, TV stations, radio stations, they're saying, you know, we're not going to give you all that free time for your debates and we're not going to give that much coverage to your campaigns, but we will run your TV ads if you give us money. And the cost of getting elected went from, you know, nationally for president, it went from, you know, millions to hundreds of millions to tens of millions, to hundreds of millions, to $1 billion in the last cycle. I mean, it was just mind-boggling. And who's getting all this money? Huge media corporations. GE owns NBC. ABC's, what you call it, the company that owns ABC. Disney. And CBS. And, you know, on it goes. I mean, right on down the list. They're the ones who are ending up with the money. So anyhow, here's the DLC. And they were successful in getting in bed with corporate interests and raising money to get Bill Clinton elected. And then, of course, he had to sell out to them. He had to pay the piper, and so he signed GATT and NAFTA, and poof, old crazy Ross Perot was right. All our jobs, not all, but, you know, millions of our jobs have vanished. Well, they haven't vanished, actually. They've moved. They're now in Mexico or China or Vietnam or whatever. And the war against organized labor has picked up steam. And so here you got the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, coming out and saying that Howard Dean, Chairman Howard Dean, they're issuing a warning to him. Democratic National League Committee Chairman Howard Dean should do no harm. And that it's a delusion to think that if we just turned out our voters, we could win national elections. What? I mean, here you have the DLC basically saying, you know, well, what we got to do is we got to go to the big corporations, get money from them, give them what they want. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. I'll tell you, in fact, it's anti-historical. They say, this is Donald Lambrow's piece in the Washington Times, they say it will take a divisive, all-out political civil war to scrub the anti-war orthodoxy out of the party's agenda, this being the Democratic Party. So they're saying that the folks in the Democratic Party who are opposed to preemptive wars are somehow going to destroy the party. Let's look at history for a moment. Woodrow Wilson, elected the Democrat, elected president back in the 19-teens, and led us into World War I. The damage that did to the Democratic Party, particularly when word got out, I mean, to this day, nobody can figure out why we entered World War I, but Wilson pioneered modern public relations, and when people realized that Wilson had basically hustled us into World War I, boom, they started voting Republican. To the point that Herbert Hoover's reelection was the second largest landslide of a sitting president in the history of the United States in 1928, when Herbert Hoover, the Republican, ran for reelection. So, you know, being a pro-war Democrat didn't help Woodrow Wilson. Lyndon Johnson in the Vietnam War, did it help him? I don't think so. In fact, he was beat by an opponent, Richard Nixon, who said, I've got a secret plan to end the war. Well, it wasn't actually LBJ that beat him, that Nixon beat. It was what's his name? You know who I'm talking about. Anyhow, Nixon had this secret plan, him and Kissinger. Of course, there was no secret plan, but that was the whole point of it. Eisenhower. Eisenhower was running for political office, and I just have to share with you a couple of Eisenhower's these are the Republicans now, and this is why, you know, this was the demise of Harry Truman. This is why in 46, in the election of 1946, both the House and the Senate went Republican, was because Harry Truman was getting us involved in Korea. And everybody was all hysterical about that. And so Ike comes in, he says, I'm going to get us out of the Korean War. Well, not just Korea. It was the tail end of World War II. And there was just such a distaste for war in the United States. Here's one of Eisenhower's TV commercials.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
A paid film.
Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. You get it? I mean, you know, and here these guys are coming along saying, you know, no party can win if it's in favor of peace. Here's another ad from the 19. This would have been the 52 election, I believe, for Eisenhower.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
A paid film.
Vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. And here we've got the DLC threatening Democrats, saying, if you say anything about being in favor of peace in the world, you're going to lose elections. And I think it's just nuts. I mean, here, the Republicans who have won in the last 100 years have all won by saying that they were anti-war. It was the Republicans who fought our getting into World War II. It was the Republicans who fought our getting into World War I. And so if the Democratic Party wants to resurrect itself, and I really believe it should, I mean, the single-party rule is not good for America here, with the Republicans controlling the House, the Senate, the White House, the Supreme Court. Here you have these 17 DLC members led by Senate Evan Bayh of Indiana writing this open letter. And Jack Bloom, a counsel for the Americans for Democratic Action, he says, I can't tell the difference between the positions the DLC puts forward and Republican policy. And neither can I. I mean, this is just incredible. What has the Republican Party done for working people in America? Virtually nothing. I mean, in 100 years, in 200 years, virtually nothing. Let me share with you a small list when we come back from this. This is the Tom Hartman radio program, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, by the way. And the chat room, tomhartman.com. Click live chat if you want to drop in there. Folks from two continents in there at the moment. Welcome you there. 20 minutes past the hour.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindball.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Yeah, Hubert Humphrey, that guy whose name I couldn't remember. LBJ's vice president. He had the taint of the Vietnam War all over him. I mean, he was a decent guy. He was a good liberal Democrat. But yes. Welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-8894, our telephone number. Derek in Woodbridge, Virginia on the line. Hey, Derek, what are your thoughts on all this?
Hello, Tom. I was just looking up some stuff on the James Zogby Washington Watch archive.
Uh-huh.
And I came across a piece from January of 1995 talking about the Newt Gingrich rise to power in the Republican Congress. And it noted that the majority of the losses by the Democrats in that previous year had been moderate DLC members.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The DLC, I would say, has been responsible for every major Democratic loss since its creation, other than the election of Bill Clinton in '92.
Absolutely.
I mean, they have turned the Democrats who have aligned with them into Republican light, and that's not what America wants. It's not what Americans want. It's not America.
Exactly.
It's Victorian.
You want a choice.
Yeah, it's 18th century England. I mean, it's going back to the Tories. It's outrageous. Thanks for the tip on that, Derek. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I think it was Tom in Minnesota called the program yesterday, and he was talking about this article in the Tulsa World, and he forwarded it to me in email. And it's just great. I just have to share a piece of this with you. It's by Clint C. Gold, and it was published in Tulsa World, I'm assuming it's a newspaper, back in 99. And this guy is like, you know, he's at a cocktail party or something, and he's sitting around with a bunch of Republicans. Actually, it's a TV football party in South Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he says, will you people name me one bill your party ever passed to help the working man of this country? This is sort of like the question that I asked Congressman Tom Tancredo from Colorado 2 years ago on this program. And, you know, we've been running this contest ever since. I'll give you a free copy of one of my books if you can name one piece of legislation that was initiated by the Republicans and signed into law by the Republicans that had as its primary beneficiary human beings, individual human beings, rather than corporations. It's just not there. Or let's say rather than corporations and, you know, churches, for example. I suppose you could toss, you know, the special interest bunch, the Republican special interest bunch. So, you know, this guy says, will you people name me one bill your party ever passed to help the working man in this country? And they couldn't say anything. And so this liberal in the room, he talks about FDR's New Deal programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Peace Corps. This is later, you know, the Medicare and Medicaid after FDR. The Peace Corps, unemployment insurance, welfare programs, which, by the way, LBJ's welfare programs cut poverty in half in America, in half. Dramatically reduced infant mortality, gave a whole lot of people bootstraps so that they could pull themselves up by. Civil rights, student grant and loan programs, safety laws, OSHA, environmental laws, prevailing wage laws, right to collective bargaining, which brought about paid medical insurance, paid vacations, pensions, workers' compensation, the Marshall Plan, flood disaster insurance, the school lunch program, women's rights, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which established the minimum wage, instituted child labor laws, and set up time and a half pay for over 40 hours a week, which Bush just rolled back. The FHA and HUD with public housing, urban renewal, 44 million residential homes. Before World War II, under the Republicans, 70% of our nation were renters. After the 1970s, that had been reversed. 70% owned their homes. Farm conservation subsidies, USDA programs, the Farmers Home Administration. The bankers didn't want to make rural loans. Small flood controls, more than 3,000 lakes in Oklahoma alone helped. Rural water districts, rural electricity, rural telephone. The GI Bill passed, which the Republicans at the time bitterly opposed. They were salivating over millions of returning veterans to hire as cheap labor. More than 8 million veterans from World War II have used college benefits, creating millions of entrepreneurs. Many had never dreamed of college. For the unemployed GI, $20 a week for 52 weeks to help get started. The Veterans Administration provided more than 2 million home loans. Every single one of these things fought tooth and nail by Republicans, passed by progressive liberal Democrats. What?
Liberradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the radio home of democracy, the No Boring Zone, the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me here with you. Broadcasting live today from the People's Republic of Vermont. Next week we'll be broadcasting live from the People's Republic of Oregon. Should be entertaining. No other changes in the program that you'll notice. You know, the liberal Democrats not only saved Americans, they saved the banks. They created the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Federal Savings and Loan Insurance Corporation. They saved Wall Street by creating the Securities and Exchange Commission. All these things that the Republicans fought against and said, no, please don't regulate us, don't do this. We just want to be, we want to have this Bob Cratchit and Scrooge and Marley world where there's a wealthy few and a lot of scared, terrified workers. One of the reasons that the Republicans so fought the Democrats after World War II, when the young men and women were coming home from World War II, on the GI Bill. Republicans didn't want to have the GI Bill. Why send them to college when you can have them work in our factories for minimum wage? And, you know, it's why they fought unionization. The Wagner Act back in 1935, and on it goes. This letter by Clint Gold, he's a former mayor of Moore, Oklahoma, apparently, retired savings and loan executive. He says, "Liberals dragged you into the 20th century scratching and screaming with your heels in the mud, fighting anything that's progressive, everything that's made this country great. You Republicans have never understood that the spending power of blue-collar workers obtained through Democrats and unions is really what made this country great. You really believe the good life was obtained from your own endeavors. You cloak your greed in religion and patriotism, railing against any form of tax, never comprehending that these programs have benefited all of us and our country." This is a keeper. It's just absolutely brilliant. And I think it was Tom who emailed it to me, whoever sent that to me. Thank you so much. I want to get on from that as well to, you know, what George Bush now has done to this country in the last 4 years. $4 trillion more in debt for Social Security. Our national debt right now stands at $7,776,939,047,670. That is $26,300 for every single one of us. Every baby that is born in America today is born owing $26,300. And over the next 6 years, Bush is planning on increasing that by $3.8 trillion. That's half again, which means every baby born in America will start out, will come into this world owing about $40,000. Every 51 days, another $87 billion is added to the national debt. You will recall on March 27th of 01, George Bush said, "And we could proceed with tax relief without fear of budget deficits, even if the economy softens." Yeah, right. According to the Congressional Budget Office, the available national debt could be paid off entirely, entirely, if George Bush had not pushed through his so-called tax increases, which are really loans. They were really borrowing from our children and our grandchildren and giving that money to his rich buddies, the millionaires and billionaires, $3.8 trillion of it. We could have paid off the debt entirely since surpluses were projected to grow large enough to allow the federal government to retire all available debt held by the public by 2009. That's the course this country was headed on before Bush came into office and changed everything with his so-called tax cuts. He squandered our surplus. 63% of the deficit last year, according to the Congressional Budget Office. This is not an arm of either party. 63% of the deficit was directly a result of these so-called tax cuts. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And let's see here, Jeff in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, I've been, you know, regarding what that one guy said about how the DNC has not won any elections for us, or rather they've lost all the elections
for us.
Well,
the DNC, dancing to the tune of the DLC, that's the Democratic National Committee, or dancing to the tune of the Democratic Leadership Council. Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's a difference. I got you. Well, I was just thinking, I've been saying this before, I think if Howard Dean really knew what he was doing and had some real leadership guts, maybe he does, maybe he doesn't, but I think he should just go out there and say, first of all, we apologize for running a lame ass like John Kerry. Second of all, we're going to just disband. We have no credibility among Americans. We're just making things worse. We are going to disband and back the Green Party. I mean, unless you got a better idea.
Yeah, the better idea is to take back the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, Howard Dean is working on that right now, in my opinion. He's out there going state to state. Yesterday, I read this letter from Candy Stroud that listed all the things that he was doing. I was just looking for it. It's in my stack of stuff from yesterday, so I can't quickly pull it out. But he has been in 17 or 18 states now. He's doing local media. And most of them red states, by the way. And he's going in and he's talking to folks, and he's saying, basically, we're taking back the party. This is why the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, is getting hysterical. They're saying, wait a minute, the Democratic Party is returning back to its roots with Franklin Roosevelt and Thomas Jefferson? We can't have that. We're supposed to be the party. We're supposed to be the Republican light.
Right.
And see, I think that the Democratic Party, the problem is this problem that James Madison identified back in Federalist Number 10 in 1787 when they were trying to sell the Constitution, that we have a two-party system of government, whether we like it or not. We can talk all day long about how wonderful it would be to have third parties and fourth parties and fifth parties. And in a country where you have proportional representation, that's possible. Like in France, for example, where or Germany, if a party gets 10% of the vote, then they get 10% of the seats in parliament, period. And they get to pick who the people are that sit there. If a party gets 30%, so the Greens could actually have a place. We don't have that here in the United States. We have what's called first-past-the-post, winner-take-all elections. And we're one of only about a half a dozen countries, democracies, left in the world that don't have proportional representation. And the result of that is, and it's because we're the oldest democracy and nobody had thought it up when we first started. I mean, we have to give credit to the founders. They did the best they could. It had never been tried before. But the reality is, as Madison pointed out, that if you have a third party, you're going to end up with people being elected who represent a minority of the people. Because, you know, with two parties, you could have 51%. You could have a theoretical majority. With three parties, you could have 30%, and 36% or whatever it would be, you know, 40%. And you still have a minority, but you have somebody who gets elected. So instead of – and I'm all in favor of the Green Party, by the way. And I want to say I totally support the Green Party at the local level. I think that at the local level, the Green Party is doing wonderful stuff. And they are really tremendous agents for change in the United States. They have been the leaders in pushing instant runoff voting, which is the way to solve this problem, by the way. They have been of two-party rule because it allows multiple parties. San Francisco now, the largest city in the United States to adopt instant runoff voting, and where you have a Green now, as I believe, the mayor is a Green. I'm all in favor of that, and in my opinion, those people who are active in the Green Party should also get active in the Democratic Party and take it back and take it over.
Because can we get rid of John Kerry? We really need to give him the boot because he's making us all look bad. He's such a lame-o.
I have a feeling he's already gotten rid of. First of all, I have to say, in my opinion, there was enough voter fraud in this last election. I think that he probably actually did win the election. But
I say that all the time. But that notwithstanding the fact that he is a lame-o,
He should have stood up when they started out. See, his problem was he'd been in the Senate too long. He actually believed in civility. When they started those Swift Boat ads and they started calling him a liar, he was so amazed he didn't believe that the American people would stand for it. He didn't believe that the news media would pick up on it. He believed everybody would look at that and go, come on, these guys are obviously lying. And they didn't. And he didn't believe, he didn't believe that Bush would lie. He didn't believe that Cheney would lie. And, you know, yeah, that's lame, you know, in retrospect.
Well, Michael Moore put it best. He said Democrats show up for a gunfight with a slingshot.
Yeah. Yeah, and Howard Dean is saying, hey, if we're going to have a gunfight, hey, here's a better metaphor. What we need to do now is take a chainsaw to a knife fight.
Yeah, but the thing is also with Kerry, when he said, knowing what we know today, I still would have voted the way I did. The weekend of the Republican convention, Tim Russert asked Hillary Clinton about that, and she goes, well, I think his point was that you can't make decisions in hindsight. It's like, that wasn't his point.
Yeah.
He forced Hillary to have to talk out her butt.
Yeah, his point was that he wanted to give the president a power. He didn't think he was giving the president the authority to go to war. But it was too nuanced. It was too subtle. I mean,
Kerry's the one that always says George Bush never came back to Congress like he said he would. So why would you give him the chance to not come back to Congress again, you schmuck?
Yeah, there you go, Jeff. I'm not all that far separate from you. I don't think that beating up on John Kerry, though, frankly, is the solution. The solution is to be proactive. The solution is to look at specific things that should and can be done. Whether they're holding actions for example, getting out there and saying, no, we're not going to allow this bankruptcy bill to get through the House of Representatives. And this is going to be the big battle this week, and they're going to do everything they can. I can tell you right now, the cons are going to do everything they can to try and change the subject to something else. But to stop the bankruptcy bill, for example, it's one of the last protections working people have in the United States. Let's get national health insurance in this country, things like that. You know, stop this privatization of Social Security, and not just stop it, but turn it around to the point that people realize, people get it, people understand in the United States that it's bad. It's bad for us, that there are some things that actually government can do better than the private sector. And it's a very specific and narrow range of things. And those are the things that have to do with the commons. Jeff, thanks for your call, by the way. I appreciate it. Those things that have to do with the commons. We don't want, like the Soviet Union had, we don't want the government in the business of building houses, of making shoes, of putting up office buildings, of building computers. That doesn't work. The government should stay out of the private sector. There's no disagreement there. Everybody understands that. But those things that have to do with our ability to survive, with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those things are too essential to simply hand over to a corporation whose first goal is not delivering the essentials of life, but is making a profit. And that's why historically we've said hospitals had to be nonprofit. And when we started allowing hospitals to be for-profit, suddenly we saw an explosion in healthcare costs. It's why we historically said that health insurance companies had to be not-for-profit. And when we allowed them to start becoming for-profit corporations, we saw an explosion in healthcare costs. It's why we historically have said that electric companies, as monopolies, as most of them are, they run their wires across our rights of way, across our property. We the people, we give them the right of way, we maintain it, we send the city out with the tree cutters or whatever, and we say, okay, you've got a monopoly, you're going to be a public utility, it's like we're going to allow you to make a profit, but not an excessive profit. And you can only make electricity, that's it. You're in the electric business, you can only make electricity. You ever play the game Monopoly? You know how if you get one of those utilities, every time you go around, you get that $100 real consistently. You're not going to get rich like with the big housing developments, and whatever is place, you know. But you get that nice steady income, and utilities have been nice steady income generators, well regulated utilities. And now we have 15 states in the United States where they've deregulated utilities, and in every single one of those states, electricity costs have exploded, and in some of those cases, you've seen people just absolutely getting just taken to the cleaners. And even governments being changed, like in California, by the utility companies because they didn't like Gray Davis. Hey, let's get rid of him. Get in Schwarzenegger. Schwarzenegger having his secret meetings at the Beverly Hills Hotel just as the rolling blackouts were starting in California. Schwarzenegger, who was an actor, he's just an actor at that point in time. He's having a secret meeting with Ken Lay and other energy industry executives at the Beverly Hills Hotel just before the brownouts begin in California. And now he's the governor. And you tell me there's no relationship between those two, that it's just a coincidence. So anyhow, here we have, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the national debt, I mentioned that, could be paid off. Bush just absolutely squandered this. Bush is saddling future generations and young people with trillions in debt. This, by the way, from Candy Stroud. This is the DNC now. Not the DLC, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, not the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC. Those are the corporate Democrats. This is the bunch now, the DNC. This is the National Democrats that Howard Dean heads up. And then I'm telling you, it's the last chance. This is the last chance for the working people of America to take back this country, is to take back the Democratic Party and make it what it once was, a party that represents the interests of working people in the United States, of the average person in the United States. Bush will pass on to future generations, number one, the $5.7 trillion cost of making his tax cuts permanent over 20 years. Number two, the $8 trillion cost of his prescription drug benefit plan over the next 75 years. And frankly, I'm all in favor of Medicare, by the way, paying for prescription drugs. But Bush had to have it. They wrote it into the law that it was illegal for the government to negotiate with drug companies for discounts. So you've got a drug that costs 5 cents, 10 cents a pill to make, and they're retailing it for $1, $2, $10 a pill. I mean, the markups in the pharmaceutical industry are mind-boggling. They don't prevent the Defense Department from negotiating discounts. The veterans hospitals can negotiate discounts. They can go to the pharmaceutical companies and say, hey, yeah, we're going to buy a million pills of penicillin this year. What's your best price? That's how Canada does it. That's why the prices are lower in Canada. The entire nation goes to the drug companies and says, give us your best price. That's the price. And so they pass this Medicare bill and they say, the government is by law not allowed to negotiate. What's that about? 10 minutes before the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small...
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
That's that light at the end of the tunnel. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. The U.S. is the largest net debtor in the world. Now, when Ronald Reagan first came into office, we were the largest creditor in the world. We were the healthiest and wealthiest economically nation on earth. And now we see 25 years of voodoo economics, of Reaganomics, have wiped us out. It's cut the bottom out of the middle class. It has dramatically increased poverty in the United States. We're like 37th in the world in terms of infant mortality. Countries like Cuba have better health care systems. You just reach a point where it's like, when do people get it? Is it going to take another Great Depression for Americans to wake up? Or are we already sliding into it? Something that I think may well be the case. Here we have more than $1.1 trillion of our $7 trillion in debt is held by 10 foreign countries. 10 countries, any one of which, if they were to start dumping our debt, could bring us to our knees. The biggest of them, China. Remember that communist country? Oh, we're afraid of communists. We don't like a communist. Yes. $194 billion the Chinese are sitting on of U.S. debt. And then you've got companies like Toyota. I mean, you know, God bless them. They're building factories here. This is not to say that they're doing anything wrong. But you've got companies, foreign-owned companies, coming into the United States and building factories here to build things here to sell to us. And it seems like a good thing at first blush. You know, all the conservatives, they say, oh, isn't this wonderful? We'll give them tax breaks if they'll come into our community. Yeah, give us jobs. Well, yes, they are paying a little payroll. But where's the profit going? I mean, after all, the reason they're in business is to make a profit. Where's the profit going? It's going back to Japan. Well, how did they buy that land for that factory in the first place? How did they get into this country in the first? The way that they got into this country is because we were buying more stuff from them than we were selling to them, and we ended up owing them money. They were taking our IOUs. There's this thing called the trade deficit. It hit $666 billion last year under George W. Bush, an all-time record high. And that's the amount of money the foreigners are holding on to now because we've bought stuff from them and we've given them IOUs in exchange for it. So they come over here and they say, hey, I think I'll buy Philadelphia. I think I'll buy Pittsburgh. I think I'll buy Chicago. And they're buying up our cities. They're buying up our countryside. They're building factories here. They're using us for labor. They're taking our raw materials and they're taking the profits home with them. In the process, America is becoming impoverished. That's Republican economics and it doesn't work.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. You're here in the real free speech zone. The Tom Hartman radio program, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Robert Zoellick, this is a Reuters report, said if the European Union ended a ban on selling arms to China, it would affect its transatlantic defense trade with the United States. Now, you get this, right? This is right after Condi Rice goes over to India and Pakistan. And all the advanced stories, I mean, everybody knew in advance that Boeing had been saying, Boeing had been saying right up front, if you don't get us some big purchasers for more of our weapons, then we're going to shut down our plants. And there's a big Boeing plant down in Texas where they're making F-16s. And they're saying, so Condi hops on a plane and she flies over to Pakistan. Now, we had not been selling these weapons to Pakistan or India because they both developed nuclear weapons outside of the provisions of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty and all that sort of stuff. And therefore had categorized themselves, at least with regard to nuclear weapons, as rogue states. But Boeing says, we got to sell these F-16s. If we don't, we're going to shut down the factory. And so Condi goes over and says, it goes to Pakistan. And yeah, Pakistan says, yeah, sure, we'll buy a bunch of those things. We would really love to have them. And then she goes to India and they say, well, we're not sure. We've been looking at the French Mirage jets. They're pretty, pretty good jets. And we've been looking at the Soviet MiGs, and, we're just not really sure we're going to buy your Boeing aircraft. And then the news comes out that Boeing is going to move their production facilities. They're only going to continue to manufacture these, even if they get the contract for Central Asia, this Pakistani-Indian contract. Even if they get it, and it looks like they have, now India is still in the balance, but they've got Pakistan, that they're going to move their manufacturing facility 5 years from now, because this is a contract that'll take, 10, 15 years to fulfill. They're going to, 5 years from now, after the next presidential election, they're going to move their manufacturing facility to India. To India. I kid you not. So, we're going around the world. We are so broke. We are so poverty-stricken. We're running around the world saying, please buy weapons from us. We've got nothing else to sell you. We have gone from being a first-world nation, that is a country that exports finished goods, that adds value to raw materials, that takes iron ore from the ground and converts it into a finished automobile, along with a whole bunch of other stuff. We've gone from being a first-world manufacturing power, primarily exporting finished goods and primarily importing raw materials, importing bananas from banana republics, importing sugar from sugarcane, wood from Canada. We have gone from being a first world nation that imports raw materials and exports finished goods to being a third world nation, a banana republic, and this is pure and simple, nothing more or less than the consequences of 25 years of conservative economics, including the DLC's embrace of Republican free trade, so-called free trade, to becoming a third world country that imports finished goods and exports raw materials. Our major exports now are agricultural products, corn, soybeans, cotton, minerals. We export gold. We export iron. We export a whole bunch of minerals that we're exporting, and of all things, wood and pulp wood. We export recyclable paper to China, and they send it back to us as the boxes that are around the computers that we're buying. This is what they've done. This is what 25 years of insane economics have done to this country. Of Reaganomics, voodoo economics, trickle-down economics, Lafler curve, whatever you want to call it, supply-side economics, whatever you want to call it, free trade, whatever you want to call it, it doesn't matter. I mean, it matters to Frank Luntz. You know, he's doing his focus groups, and he's getting all the words right, so all the Americans will think, oh, this is all this is just wonderful. But just look around you. We manufacture now 16% of what we produce. That's a disaster. We are a country that could not survive if the world, if the rest of the world cut us off. And the only reason that the rest of the world keeps feeding us stuff, including food, this year, 2005, for the first time, we became a country that imported more food than it exported. Go to your supermarket, most of the stuff that's out of season is coming from South America. We are importing food. And the only reason that the rest of the world is shipping this stuff to us is because, for the moment, they're willing to take our debt. And because we have changed our laws, going back to Reagan, we have changed our laws in this country to such an extent that a foreign company can come into our country and simply buy up big chunks of land, build factories, make cars, make whatever they want, and take the profits home with them. It is the neocon notion of free trade. It's what we've imposed on Iraq. And the Iraqis are having nothing to do with it. They're quite upset about this, the fact that we changed their constitution so that labor unions in the public sector are illegal, that we changed their constitution so that any corporation, any multinational corporation can come into Iraq, set up business, and take 100% of their profits out, that if somebody's going to sell something in Iraq, it doesn't have to have a certain percent of the content manufactured in Iraq. I mean, other countries protect their economies. China does. Japan does. Most of the nations of Europe still do. India certainly does. Pakistan does. We don't. Why? Because of a bunch of right-wing ideologues who came to power with Ronald Reagan have been steering the economic policies of this country ever since, and they have driven us right flat into the ditch. And so now here we have Robert Zoellick, the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State, the number two guy under Condi Rice, and he's trying to tell the European Union that they can't sell weapons to China. And the EU leaders are going, who do you think you are? The U.S., you guys will take on a third world country with no air force that you've for 10 years starved with sanctions. You'll go in and kick the butt of Iraq, right? Big deal. Big deal. I mean, they had fought a 10-year war with Iran where they'd lost over a million of their soldiers. Their army was 15-year-old recruits wearing rags. They had out-of-date weapons. They couldn't even shoot down our planes flying over them. We had bombed them back to the Stone Age. They had one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. We weren't even allowing them to build infrastructure back. We wouldn't let them import chlorine to purify their water because we said they could make it into poison gas. And then we attacked them, and we had a great victory. Great victory over one of the world's most powerful armies. Yes, indeed. Oh, we can strut around on that one, yes. Several countries, especially the United States and Britain, have been critical of the plan to lift the arms embargo, notably in light of the rising Chinese tension with Taiwan, notes Reuters. Yeah. And what are you going to do, Condi, George, Dick? What are you going to do when China says, you know, we're going to take back Taiwan, and if you try and stop us, we're going to stop buying your treasuries. We're going to stop loaning you money. We might even stop selling you stuff. After all, the Europeans are pleased to buy it from us. South America is pleased to buy it from us. Multinational corporations are not just in the United States anymore. That's why they're called multinationals. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, the website. If you want to drop into our chat room, click live chat. It'll take you to the message board where there's some 50, 60,000 messages. You're welcome to participate there. And while you're there, you click live chat. It'll take you to our live chat room. Joe in South Dakota on the line. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just wanted to explain, you guys are like a breath of fresh air. What I really wanted to get across was how effective this Republican propaganda machine is.
Oh, it's mind-boggling. It's just absolutely mind-boggling. Right. You know, but they've had 25 years to do it, and the Democrats haven't been noticing. I mean, it's like they've been out to lunch.
Okay, my thing is they've literally terrorized this area. I mean, when Bush came here to do a presidential congressman running thing for John Thune, third grade student in Brookings, South Dakota, went around making some comment about Bush and yada yada, and the Secret Service arrested this third grade child.
Yeah.
And hauled him and his family to jail, and they just turned their lives upside down. Then it's just.
Yeah, it's
that's a sheer terror that the Republicans and their propaganda machine are putting into the people in this area.
Yep, and last week George Bush showed up for one of his little town hall meetings on Social Security, which is paid for with your tax dollars and mine. This was not a campaign stop; it was not a private GOP event. And there were three people who had tickets, which now you have to have tickets to hear your president, right? Well, they'd gotten their tickets from their Republican congressman, and they were all vetted, and they went in and they sat down, and a guy comes over dressed up like he's the Secret Service. Turns out he wasn't. He was actually with the GOP. He was actually a Republican operative pretending to be the Secret Service, right down to the little pin on his lapel and the thing in his ear, you know, and he was, you know, the whole brush cut, the whole bit, wearing a black suit, and he comes over and he says, "You've got to leave." And he leads them out, and so they went to the Secret Service, and they said, "Why'd you throw us out?" And the Secret Service says, "Oh, we didn't throw you out. It was the Republicans." And they said, "Well, why did the Republicans throw you out?" And they said, "Well, they were going through the cars in the parking lot, and they found a car that had a no more blood for oil bumper sticker on it, and they did a search on it, and they found out whose it was, and they looked through the tickets, and they found out it was you guys, or it was one of you, you know, who owned the car, and they had the tickets had the seat numbers, and so they came to your seat, and they hauled you away." And these people, I mean, they weren't there to disrupt anything. They just wanted to hear what the president had to say. Yeah, well, you know, it's like, what has happened to America?
That's exactly my point. Okay, now 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago or last month, a seventh grader wrote an article condemning Bush's policies and whatnot, and he was arrested.
Yeah, it's over the top, and now you've got the Supreme Court here yesterday saying that you know, the dogs sniff, they can come to your house with sniffing dogs, and they can poke around and check you out without having any probable cause. I thought they had to have some sort of probable cause before they could basically snoop on you. But no, the snooping is getting bigger and better. Of course, under the Patriot Act, they don't even have to tell you. They don't even have to have a warrant. They can do a sneak and peek now. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There's the man.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Truth in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Time for our daily check-in with what's going on in Washington, D.C. with Talk Radio News Service. And it's Ellen Ratner. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the Democrats are here up at the White House. Actually, at the Capitol. I'm going to be calling you from the White House tomorrow, where they're getting all the radio hosts who are on their side, plus me, to broadcast from the Treasury Department on the issue of Social Security. The Democrats are basically saying, hey, let's essentially bring them on. Let the president go and continue to promote his program, because the more he promotes his Social Security program, the less popular he gets.
Yeah.
Now, it's very interesting. that our buddy Mr. Hoyer, now he is a Democrat, he's a minority whip, and he said that he had a very interesting event and in his home district the other day, and that there were all kinds of people with signs out when he did a Social Security event saying that Hoyer does not tell the truth and Hoyer lies. And so what he did is he invited all these people into his town hall meeting,
uh-huh,
and let them ask questions, which, as he pointed out, is very different than what the Republicans are doing.
Yeah. Boy, is it different
in their event.
Yeah, well, you've got to sign a loyalty oath. Yeah, but
exactly.
I got my platinum card the other day, by the way. I sent $5 to the GOP, and I got a platinum membership card.
Well, I should share with you, I have this big event that invites me to be a member of a special club because of my great support for the Republican Party. I have it framed.
There you go. Here we are. It gets you some very strange email, I'll tell you. It's,
the other thing that Hoyer talked about this morning is essentially that he thinks that what's happening with this whole business of Senator I can never pronounce his name, from Texas.
Mm-hmm. Cornyn.
And he is essentially saying that all of these remarks that he talked about this business with the judges and all that,
right,
he says it's very regrettable. He said that what he has been saying is absurd and dangerous. And he also said that it looks like that in terms of the filibuster rule, which I talked to you about yesterday, that obstructionism is in the eye of the beholder, and it looks like the Democrats are not afraid to go after this issue if they pass the anti-filibuster rule.
Finally, they're standing up. Did you see where the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, of Evan Bayh and 17 other members of Congress?
Pro-war.
Yes, pro-war. Now, tell me, if you can tell me, whose campaign commercial this little clip came from. Just listen very carefully.
November 4th, vote for peace.
November 4th, vote for peace.
November 4th, vote for peace.
Who is that?
Boy, I don't know.
Eisenhower.
Oh, really?
Yep, that was his platform. 1952. Eisenhower, he was going to end the war in Korea, and he did. And, he was the peace candidate. Just like Nixon was against Humphrey. Humphrey had the Vietnam War, and Nixon came in and said, "I'm the peace candidate. I've got a secret plan for peace." And now you've got Evan Bayh and these DLC Democrats saying, "Oh, you got to come in as the party of war." Come on.
Well, everybody sees Evan Bayh as being able to make it in Iowa. I don't know. I've traveled in Iowa a lot with candidates. I don't see it.
Yeah. This guy, in my mind, is just an absolute total sellout.
I think you've got to start looking at Richardson.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Maybe. I don't know enough about Richardson, but anybody's better than Evan Bayh right now, in my mind, I tell you.
Clinton voted for the war, too.
Yeah, don't get me started. Frankly, I don't know enough about Hillary yet to have a strong opinion. But if she's going to follow the DLC line, then I'm not going to support her either. It's just where I'm at.
Count on it.
Anyhow, 29 minutes past the hour. Ellen, thanks so much for the call.
You're
I appreciate
welcome.
It. Talk Radio News Service, Ellen Radner. Good to hear from you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I can hear the soft breathing of the girl that I love as she lies here beside me, asleep with the night.
A flashback. Welcome back. 27 minutes, 26 and a half minutes before the hour. Where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. in a Republican administration. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Raymond in Cement City, Michigan on the line. Hey, Raymond, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon, Tom. Hey, listen, moving right along here, I always wanted to ask you if you've ever looked at anything that's been written by Paul Ray regarding the new political compass concept that he has been discussing.
Yeah. Paul Ray was the guy who along with his wife, whose name escapes me at the moment, founded the whole notion of
Sherry Anderson.
The cultural creatives and all this.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Have you looked at his political compass concept? He's got a 58-page summary out, and he's basically saying that, you know, the past was a left-right thing, and both of them are dwindling or have dwindled. And in those are the East-West, and in the South, you've got the corporatists, you know, the corporate people that are,
right.
are
corporatism versus populism,
right? And and so that the true North really deals with the where most people are in the political spectrum. And
yeah, I've read it. I think he makes it far more complicated than it needs to be. Number one, and number two, I don't think it's anything new. I mean, what he's talking about basically is the platform that Teddy Roosevelt was running on with the Bull Moose Party.
Yeah, well, I think we need something to grasp onto. We can't have a lot of these different concepts together. We've got to coalesce around.
Well, I think if we're going to grasp onto something, I think that people who are Republicans. And God bless them in this country, people who really believe in the Republican Party and its historic principles need to take it back to its roots, back to Dwight Eisenhower, back to the traditional consistent beliefs of the Republican Party of fiscal sanity, of not running the country into debt, of not giving away your country to foreign ownership, of not surrendering sovereignty to multinational corporations. And people who are Democrats and have a Democratic tendency need to take back the Democratic Party and once again make it the party that represents the interests of the average working person and labor in this country.
Yeah, well, you know, Tom, I've been trying to work in the local Democratic Party structure, and what I'm seeing is that it's so run by the union organizations, and there's such limited outreach to these other sectors in the community, which I feel fit into this more true North.
Well,
that's where
what you need to do is what, you know, many of the callers of this program, Jeff and up in Denver has done, and what's his name in New Mexico, is infiltrate the party. Take it over from within. Just, you know, get on the inside, and if your voice isn't enough, bring five friends. I mean, infiltrate the party and take it over.
It's just like the theme that you just played from Eisenhower, about peace.
Yeah.
We need a theme that's consistent with the need of our community, of the people that live in this country today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like...
How about America for Americans?
Yes.
I mean, you know, a little nationalistic and a little patronizing, but I mean, that ultimately, what has happened is that the cons have brought us America for the multinationals.
Right.
And they were all, you know, I mean, they spent the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s all hysterically worried about the communists are going to come and get us or the UN is going to get us. And in fact, the folks who were coming to get us were the multinational corporations, and they got us.
Well, here's a point I really want to make in summary is that I know the things that you talk about that you have problems with on Clinton, but I think that the American people abandoned him. I think he would be more likely to get something done for people. I think that was his true motivation.
Oh, yeah.
But nobody would support him. He got wiped out in his run for governor reelection.
Yeah.
Until he figured out the corporations took him out because he put too much pressure on him.
Yeah, I know. And that's where I say for me the verdict is still out on Hillary because I just don't know where she's going to come down on all this stuff and she hasn't said yet either. She's still testing the winds.
Well, we have to give these politicians some hope that there's a public there that will support them if they're going to go out and work for our benefit.
There you go.
We're not really doing that.
Yeah, there you go, Raymond. I absolutely agree with you and salute you in your efforts to do that, and thank you for the call. David in Nashville, North Carolina on the line. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I got a question that since the government policies are really eroding the middle class, I'm curious about how that erodes our purchasing power, and if it does, isn't that going to really hurt the corporations? Aren't they shooting themselves in the foot?
Well, it would. It will hurt American corporations, and this is who has been hurt, by the way. If you're over 30 or 35 years old, you remember. Are you, by the way?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, then you remember a time in America where you could drive from one town to another and see completely different kinds of stores in the downtowns.
Right.
And those were all locally owned businesses, small businesses. They were all 100% American businesses. Now you drive into a town and all the restaurants, I mean, you could drive through Paris, you could drive through downtown London, you can drive through Hong Kong, you could drive through New Delhi, and you will see McDonald's, you'll see Walmart, you'll see, I mean, you know, it's right there.
Yeah, I call it the United States of generica.
There you go, absolutely. And so what has happened is exactly what you're describing, and that is that the truly American companies, the small and medium-sized businesses, to use Teddy Roosevelt's phrase, the companies that built this nation and made this nation great, have been wiped out by these huge multinational monoliths whose only interest is the bottom line. And if that means selling the United States down the river, they don't care.
Even the big box stores will get hit, won't they, if the middle class really crashes and burns?
No, the big box, it's really interesting. This is I did a show, actually, on this about 2 months ago, because there was a really great piece in the Wall Street Journal, of all places, on this, where they pointed out that we are rapidly becoming what they call the Walmart and Tiffany economy. And that is to say that people are either buying at the very cheapest store they can find, because they have no money and they're just scraping by, or you've got the very rich. And all those stores in the middle that cater to what used to be called the middle class, the Sears, it's not the cheapest, but it's durable. But it's not, you're not paying Saks Fifth Avenue prices for fashion at Sears, but you're getting a pair of pants that are going to last. But it's more expensive than Walmart. They're going out of business, or they're having a real hard time, because that middle class just isn't there anymore. It is evaporating.
Worst case scenario, we're all still going to be able to shop at Walmart,
That's the direction that it's heading, is the increasing poverty in the United States at the same time that a very small number, this top 3%, are becoming increasingly more wealthy. Thanks for the call, David. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Let's talk about, Republican principles, as in a republic or as in the party. And let me share with you just a few thoughts of Dwight Eisenhower. After we brought up Dwight Eisenhower, I think this is so important. People, whether you're Republican or Democrat, people have lost contact. We have lost our connections to our history, to our roots, to our past. And listen, this is Dwight Eisenhower. In 1964, at the Republican National Convention in 1964, where Barry Goldwater was nominated, I just want to share a couple of pieces of this.
There is only one real peace now, and that is peace for all time.
This is again Dwight D. Eisenhower, former president of the United States, Republican, speaking at the Republican National Convention. He says there's only one peace for all time. In other words, we're in the nuclear age. Things could spiral out of control. We can't have another war. And keep in mind, this is the guy who led the invasion of Normandy. This is the guy, I'm sitting here. I'm not a pacifist. If World War II were going on right now, I would sign up. But and Dwight Eisenhower fought the battle. And yet, he's also saying you don't go off half-cocked. You don't go fighting wars just because you want the oil. You don't go fighting wars just, Well, let's listen to what Eisenhower said rather than my putting words in his mouth.
Now, there are three imperatives of peace, three requirements that the prudent man must face with unblinking realism.
And this is fascinating. His whole concept, it's sort of like the four freedoms that Roosevelt talked about. These are the three requirements of peace. Keep in mind, Eisenhower was always the peace candidate.
The first imperative is the elementary necessity of maintaining our own national strength, moral, economic, and military.
Okay, so we have to have a strong military, right? We've got to have a strong economy. Well, unfortunately, the cons and the Republican Party have hollowed out our economy. And we've got to have a strong moral basis. And this is one of the most interesting things. There's a book called After the Empire by Immanuel Todd, which is going to be my Buzz Flash book of the month next month. It is the best-selling book in Europe right now. It's written originally in French. It's published by all the leaders of Europe. Everybody in Europe has read this thing, and it's about the fall of the American Empire. And in that book, Todd devotes an entire chapter to how America has lost its moral leadership in the world. That in Tiananmen Square, the people were going out there marching to their death, to their imprisonment, carrying a 36-foot-tall papier-mâché statue of liberty they called the Goddess of Liberty, and quoting Thomas Jefferson. We were the nation that everybody looked to and said, we want to be just like them. And now we're the nation that is outsourcing torture, that is giving people that has the guy who wrote the policy that allows torture, and Alberto Gonzalez has been elevated to head of Homeland Security at the FBI and everything else. And it's not that, like, I'm opposed to getting information out of people. The problem with torture is twofold. Number one, it doesn't work. The CIA, ask anybody in intelligence, anybody in the military, they will tell you the first thing. Number one, you don't get good information with torture. What you want to do is you want to induce the Stockholm Syndrome in people. You want them to empathize with you. It's why George Washington had standing order, that whenever a British soldier was taken, they were to be treated very well and given good meals. And all those British soldiers suddenly said, hey, you guys aren't so bad. A lot of them stayed here and helped build this country. So, number one, torture doesn't work. And number two, it causes people to think that you are not the moral leader of the world. And when you lose that moral leadership, you've lost your greatest power, as Eisenhower pointed out.
It is still my conviction, as I wrote in 1947, the compelling necessities of the moment leave us no alternative to the maintenance of real and respectable strength, not only in our moral rectitude and our economic power, but in terms of adequate military preparedness. And our economic power, as everyone knows, is displaying a capacity for growth which is both rapid and sound.
This changed a little bit since then. Sorry, ever since Ronnie Reagan got into office, it's changed. But
even while supporting record military budgets, we must keep it growing. But moral strength is also essential.
Moral strength is also essential. Gay marriage was not even in his mind. He's talking about our standing in the world.
Today, we are competing for men's hearts and minds and trust all over the world. In such a competition, what we are at home and what we do at home is even more important than what we say abroad. Here again, my friends, we find constructive work for each of us.
For each of us. This is such a critical point. It's such a critical point. Where are the statesmen anymore who would speak like Eisenhower did?
What each of us does, how each of us acts, has an influence on this question. Now, the second imperative of peace is collective security. We live in a shrunken world, a world in which oceans are crossed in hours, a world in which a single-minded despotism menaces the scattered freedoms of scores of struggling independent nations.
He was speaking, of course, at that time of the Soviet Union.
To ensure the combined strength of friendly nations is for all of us an elementary matter of self-preservation, as elementary as having a stout militia in the days of the flintlock.
In other words, you have to have partners to maintain peace. You can't go it alone. You'll recall the national security policy of the United States issued by the Bush administration in 2001 said, we will not allow any other nation to challenge our supremacy. We are going to go it alone, essentially. And what does Eisenhower say about that?
Again, the strength I speak of is not military strength alone. The heart of the collective security principle is the idea of helping other nations to realize their own potentialities, political, economic, and military. The strength of the free world lies not in cementing the free world into a second monolithic mass to compete with that of the communists,
like we are doing now.
It lies rather in the unity that comes of the voluntary association of nations, which, however diverse, are developing their own capacities and asserting their own national destinies in a world of freedom and of mutual respect.
In a world of freedom and of mutual respect. And, of course, in that moment, Eisenhower was speaking of the United Nations and our participation in the United Nations. This was during the time Dag Hammarskjöld was, was it right after he died? Perhaps it was. And in any case, this was just after Dag Hammarskjöld had been in the United Nations and just an absolute as Secretary General. And the whole idea that we could work together with other countries to try to elevate people rather than get into some sort of bizarre competition for who's going to have the biggest weapons, who's going to have the most power, who's going to control the economy. And the result of that competition now has been that China has raised itself to the point where they control so much of our economy that we no longer can say no to a nation that historically we've said, hey, wait a minute, these guys are dictators. They murder their own people. They have no moral standing. They have no moral strength. And yet we are now terrified of them because of the economic policies that have been pursued since Reagan. This is nuts.
Attention, Tom Hartman listeners. I'm here with Brush Lindball.
This is the old Brush Show.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring.
Oh, sing it, Tom.
All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
No, I'm sorry. Ronnie Reagan started this thing, and Mr. Bush Sr. have carried it forward, and Bill Clinton put his hand into it, in fact, with GATT and NAFTA, and now your job is in China. Sorry. Anyhow, we've heard what Dwight Eisenhower had to say about the United Nations and about the whole notion of interdependence with the world. Let's hear what now the fellow that we've nominated, that George W. Bush has put forward to be our ambassador to the United Nations, that Eisenhower thought so highly of, the Republican National Convention in 1964 applauded. The man that, by the way, 59 former U.S. ambassadors, 46 of them having served in Republican administrations, just wrote a letter to the president saying, please don't send this man to the U.N. Here is John Bolton.
The point that I want to leave with you in this very brief presentation is where I started, is there is no United Nations. There is an international community that occasionally can be led by the only real power left in the world, and that's the United States, when it suits our interests, and when we can get others to go along. Secretariat building.
Isn't this incredible?
In New York has.
Now, then you know, one of the diplomats. This was at a meeting. One of the diplomats just freaked out when he said
38 stories. If you lost.
Let me go back to Bolton though. Here, this just. And then we'll hear from the other diplomat.
The building in New York has 38 stories. If you lost 10 stories today, it wouldn't make a bit of difference.
And then
this
what?
Kind of mindless creation of the United Nations as something different from what it's in the United States' interest to do isn't going to sell here or anywhere else.
The United States mindless?
I don't believe for a single second that most of the good Americans who worked to get the seat on American soil would accept some of the arguments that we have just heard. In fact, I think some of them would be turning in their graves, as we say in Ireland, by what we have been listening to.
From the Irish ambassador to the United
Nations. The United States makes the UN work when it wants it to work. And that is exactly the way it should be, because the only question for the United States is what's in our national interest. And if you don't like that, I'm sorry, but that is the fact.
And this guy now is going to be our ambassador to the UN? Yes, of course we have a national interest. And yes, of course, everything we do should be in the context of our national interest. But you don't shove people's noses in it. It's called being a diplomat, Mr. Bolton. Anyhow, Tom Hartman here with you. Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system. Interesting article in the, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal today, about how Sirius and XM are growing. Beaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, American FM on Live 365. Remember John Henry Cisneros? Not John, Henry. Good old Henry Cisneros, the guy that Bush had made his housing secretary. And it turned out that Henry had been having a little affair on the side. And, of course, this was during the Clinton administration, so the Republicans had to investigate it. Now, they haven't been able to investigate, you know, who outed Valerie Plame or who, you know, any of the 50-some-odd major felonies that have been attributed to members of this administration so far. But they are still investigating Henry Cisneros. He's even pleaded guilty and paid a fine. In September 1999, he paid a $10,000 fine and a $25 court assessment. He was, see, this all started in 1995. David M. Barrett was appointed independent counsel, and he spent more than $1.26 million of federal money investigating Henry Cisneros last year. See, it's still going on. He had, by the time Clinton pardoned Cisneros in 1999, Barrett had already spent $10.3 million on his investigation. But he's a good Republican lawyer, you know, and so we've got to have this. The independent counsel law has lapsed. No more independent counsels. But Barrett stayed in business, writes Jonathan Weissman in the Washington Post. He's been spending about $1 million every 6 months. Not bad work if you can get it. I mean, this administration's way of kind of making up for all the outsourcing. The fact that they're saying, well, outsourcing is good. It's a good thing that you've lost your job to people in China and India, because that means that the corporation is more profitable, which means that the rich people will have more money to invest, which means they might build a factory and hire you someday. Or they might put their money in a Swiss bank account. I guess you'll just have to take that chance. But trust us. Yeah. So Barrett has stayed in business. Even though Cisneros pled guilty, paid a fine, and has been pardoned. 7 different independent counsels were started during the Clinton administration. But the ones started by Ken Starr continues. According to the GAO, the General Accounting Office, Julie Thomas, the third independent counsel to lead the Starr probe, spent $137,700 from April to September of 2004. April, May, June, July, August, September. 6 months. 6 months, $137,000 investigating Vince Foster's suicide and the firings at the White House travel office. I'm talking about 6 months ago. They are still looking into this. Ken Starr's investigation continues. The investigation, Barrett's investigation into Henry Cisneros continues. I'm telling you, once these Republicans get their fingers in, they get their hands on your wallet, they never let go. They will suck you dry. put them in charge of the government. Oh, Halliburton has stolen $100 billion, million, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. Well, the Pentagon can't account for $3 trillion. Say, that's all right. It's our friends, you know. In the final 6 months of fiscal 2003, notes the Washington Post, in this article by Jonathan Weissman, the final 6 months of 2003, now this wasn't the end of the investigation, this was just, you know, an accounting period. 6 months, 2003, Barrett spent $839,085. In the first half of 2004, he spent $871,204. This is investigating Henry Cisneros, whether or not the guy committed a crime by hiring his mistress. A crime Henry Cisneros has already pled guilty to, paid a $10,000 fine for, paid court costs for, and then subsequently been pardoned for. But we still need to investigate it. And in the most recent six-month span, now you would think that by now they would have figured out, hey, first of all, this happened 10 years ago. Secondly, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the guy was convicted. He pled guilty. He was hit with a fine. He paid the fine. He admitted he did it. 4 years ago, the president pardoned him, so you can't prosecute him any farther for it. So you would think that this guy Barrett, this special counsel, would say, well, you know, time to wind this thing up. Time to slow it down. Time to move on. Time to get on to something else, right? I mean, okay, the last 6 months of 2003, he spent $839,000 of your tax money and mine. First half of 2004, he spent $871,000. It's a little bit more, but, you know, it's in the $800,000 every six-month range. But in the most recent six-month span, Mr. Barrett, the guy investigating Henry Cisneros, David M. Barrett, an independent counsel, in the most recent 6 months, he spent $1.26 million of your tax money. As Hodge Henry, the Assistant Director of Financial Management and Assurance at the Government Accounting Office, the investigative arm of Congress, said, there is a trend, and it's not a decline. Now, let's compare this with Patrick Fitzgerald. Patrick Fitzgerald is also an investigator, a special counsel. He was appointed to look into a crime or the allegation of a crime. The crime being the CIA had set up a phony operation. They had set up a corporation, a multinational corporation, with offices all over the world. And it was entirely staffed by CIA operatives. And this corporation was appearing to do some normal kind of business, and they let it be known in the dark alleyways that they were willing to sell Stinger missiles and machine guns and weapons to terrorists, basically. And so the terrorists would show up at these offices in Prague or in Madrid or in Athens or in Beirut. And they'd say, I'd like to buy some Stinger missiles. And so these folks would say, cool, you know, you got some money? Yeah, I got some money. Well, who are you? And, and they'd find out. And this was an operation that was started during the Clinton administration to find out, to try and get its fingers into the bin Laden organization, to try and stop bin Laden before he could attack the United States. And they were making progress. And the woman who was running this thing, who had been a CIA agent for 20-some-odd years, and nobody knew this. Everybody thought she was a successful businesswoman. And she ran the Washington office of this multinational corporation, the headquarters, that was really a front for the CIA. She had the misfortune of being the wife of the United States' former ambassador to Niger. The former ambassador to Afghanistan, too, as I recall. And Joe Wilson. And Joe Wilson, having been an ambassador in Africa, when the claims that there was uranium from Africa being sold to Saddam Hussein, he said, I could check this out for you. And he goes down and he checks it out. And he comes back and he says, hey, there's nothing to it. It ain't happening. And Bush goes and in his State of the Union, he says, we have British intelligence tells us that there's uranium in Niger, Saddam Hussein. And so Joe Wilson, knowing that this is a lie, writes an op-ed piece in the Washington or in the New York Times that says, or was it the Washington Post? I don't recall. I think it was the New York Times that says, George Bush just lied to us, guys. I'm the one who did the investigation. And I can tell you, it didn't happen. And everybody in the Bush administration, by the way, knows it didn't happen. And so what happens? Well, Bob Novak, as John Stewart likes to refer to him, a scumbag for liberty, Bob Novak, who is, oddly enough, not being threatened with going to jail, and five other reporters who are all threatened with going to jail, were contacted by somebody high up in the administration. The best guess these days is that it was Scooter Libby, Dick Cheney's number two guy. Or perhaps Karl Rove. And they were told, hey, did you know that Joe Wilson's wife is a CIA agent? And Bob Novak published that in his syndicated column in the Chicago Sun-Times, and it outed Valerie Plame, and the CIA immediately had to shut down all these offices and call these agents in. And we don't, to this day, we don't know if any of them died. Because all of a sudden, the terrorists who were dealing with these people, thinking that they were buying weapons from them, suddenly knew that they were dealing with CIA agents. Somebody outed a CIA operation, what George Bush Sr. called treason. And when they went to George Bush Jr. and said, what about this? He said,
and I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
I don't have any idea. And so, in contrast, now, this is being investigated by Patrick Fitzgerald, special counsel. In contrast, the GAO reported Patrick Fitzgerald, who is conducting an investigation into the leak of an intelligence officer's name, spent $584,000, less than half of what was spent on investigating Henry Cisneros. In all of 2004, he only spent $611,000, whereas the guy this investigating the Valerie Plame outing, a real crime that just happened, whereas the guy who was investigating Henry Cisneros spent $2.13 million in the same period. Have they gone nuts in Washington? 20 minutes after the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like
the...
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Keeping democracy alive even as conservatives try to pull a plug and sell off the body parts. Tom Hartman here with you. The Tom Hartman program. Boy, in England, in the United Kingdom, or in the England part of the United Kingdom, they're keeping the faith in Birmingham. Or Birmingham. I actually gave a speech there. In fact, I've given speeches there twice on attention deficit disorder. Once there's a university there, and then once to a parents group. This was, I don't know, 6-8 years ago. Anyhow, a judge investigating vote rigging in Birmingham's local elections has ruled there was widespread fraud and has ordered new elections. What do we have to do to get judges like that here in the United States? How much do we have to pay them? What do we have to offer them? What does it take? You've got the only person who did any investigation whatsoever of the massive vote fraud in the state of Ohio in 2004 was John Conyers and a few Democrats who joined him. Stephanie Tubbs Jones and so on, but mostly John Conyers. And what a brave man. And he went down there right into the belly of the beast and you know, checked the situation out. What's going on here in Ohio? And they wrote a report, and you read that report, and it's mind-boggling. Your eyes cross. It's like, I can't believe they got away with this. And it got no publicity whatsoever. Here you've got a member of Congress outing massive, widespread vote fraud in Ohio in the 2004 election, and it gets no coverage in the mainstream media. So Judge Mallory said evidence of massive, systematic, and organized fraud in the campaign had made a mockery of the election and ruled that not less than 1,500 votes had been cast fraudulently in the city. The deputy high court judge said the system was hopelessly insecure and expressed regret that recent warnings about the failings had been dismissed by the government as scaremongering. So well done in the UK. And thanks to Sue in our chat room for pointing that out, Sue who lives in the UK. And now in Ohio, what's going on? Kind of the flip side of this. This from the New York Times, an article by James Dow. Conservative Christian leaders from scores of Ohio's fastest growing churches are mounting a campaign to win control of local government posts and Republican organizations, starting with the 2006 governor's race. And guess who? They're going to be pushing. It's going to be Ken Blackwell, the guy who was in charge of the vote fraud in 2004. In a manifesto, writes James Dow, that is being circulated among church leaders and on the Internet, the group, which is called the Ohio Restoration Project, is planning to mobilize 2,000 evangelical, Baptist, Pentecostal, and Roman Catholic leaders in a network of so-called patriot pastors to register 500,000 new voters, enlist activists, train candidates, and endorse conservative causes in the next year. That's because next year, in the 2006 election, Ken Blackwell won't be able to rig the election because he'll be running in the election. So they're going to have to win it fair and square. The initial goal is to elect Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell, a conservative Republican, governor in 2006. The group hopes to build grassroots organizations in Ohio's 88 counties and take control of local Republican organizations. You noted, by the way, the stuff about, you know, parts of that were my editorial comment. Hopefully you didn't think that the whole thing was James Dow's article. But back to the article. Republican officials are watching warily. Now, this is interesting. Chairman of the state party, Robert T. Bennett, warned that the decade-long dominance of his party could be jeopardized if it was pushed too far to the right. This is the party of the big tent, Mr. Bennett said. See, what's really going on, I'll tell you what's really going on. What's really going on is, just like you've got Republicans telling Catherine Harris, please don't run for the United States Senate. You're too closely associated with the stealing of the 2000 election by bouncing 70, 80, 90,000 African Americans off the voter rolls in Florida just before the 2000 election. Just like they're asking Catherine Harris not to run for the Senate. The Republicans in Ohio are starting to get a little worried about Ken Blackwell running for governor of Ohio. Be interesting to see how this one plays out. 29 minutes past the hour.
At laborradio.org.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Come all you good workers, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on, boys?
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
increasingly it's coming down to that. You've got Schwarzenegger now running around California with his $100,000 a person dinners, raising money to try to destroy organized labor in the state of California. I mean, this is mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. And you've got Newt Gingrich coming out saying, what, is he nuts? He's upsetting organized labor. He's upsetting seniors. He's talking about privatizing Social Security. He's upsetting Democrats. Well, no, he's not nuts, because what Gingrich apparently hasn't figured out, which surprises me, frankly, is that these guys really think it's possible that they can have a Stalinist state. That they can have a state, they can have single party rule where there is no opposition. The opposition can yell and scream all they want, they have no power. And this is what the end of the filibuster is about in the United States Senate. This is what redistricting was all about in Texas. This is what the electronic voting machines were all about in Georgia in 2002. And this is what Schwarzenegger is about in California right now. This is one of the reasons why George W. Bush will not allow any dissent whatsoever in any of the speeches he gives or in his own cabinet. We are not looking at people who are strong. We are not looking at an economy that is healthy. We are looking at people who are weak and afraid. And they are out of that fear, they are afraid of we the people. They are afraid of the rabble. They are afraid of working people. And so they are, as quickly as they can, trying to gain absolute control over every dimension of our lives so that we will represent no threat to their power. I don't think people realize how far this has gone. Truly dangerous times. Or, as the old Chinese curse, interesting times that we live in. Speaking of which, time for our Bush Green Watch alert. Colorado landowners lose crucial battle to oil and gas industry. I love this music, don't you? Uh-oh. Private landowners in Colorado lost a controversial legal battle to the oil and gas industry last week. At issue is a bill that would have given private landowners more say in dealing with oil and gas companies drilling on their land. This is from bushgreenwatch.org, by the way. The bill aimed to ensure fair negotiations between landowners and oil companies in order to address conflicts between landowners and oil and gas companies over what are called split estates. This is where one person owns the surface land and another owns the resources beneath it. Currently, federal rules are in industry's favor as they grant priority to mineral or resource owners. This is a big thing, by the way. Those of you who are familiar with the history of the 1930s, of the Great Depression, although it wasn't just limited to the Great Depression, but it was really big then. When they were discovering oil in the 30s in the Midwest, in Oklahoma and Texas, They were still drilling for oil and finding it in Ohio and Michigan and places like this, and coal, of course, in Appalachia. And the company representatives would come in and they'd say, "Will you sell the mineral rights to your land? We'll give you $100 right now for the mineral rights to your land." And the people would say, "Well, what does that mean? Are you offering to buy my house? Oh no, your house is fine. It can stay right where it is." "Well, what do you want?" "We just want the minerals underneath it. And we may set up an oil well over there in the corner or something like that. We'll keep it out of the way, and after we take the oil, it'll go, you know, and everything will be just fine. Don't worry about it." And people would sell the mineral rights, and then they would come in and say, "Okay, here we are. We're going to strip mine it. We're going to take everything. Your house is toast. But wait a minute, I still own this land." "Well, yeah, theoretically, sort of." A lot of people got very badly screwed in this deal. So here, as this story continues, adding an increased sense of urgency to the matter, loosened regulations and weakened public health laws have enabled a dramatic boost in oil and gas drilling throughout the Rocky Mountain states over the past 4 years. Earlier this year, Wyoming passed a law similar to the Colorado bill that died in the Colorado legislature. It actually got passed in Wyoming. Maybe that's because Dick Cheney owns so much land there, and he owns the mineral rights to his own land. In any case, the law requires oil and gas companies to notify landowners prior to drilling and calls for mineral property owners to enter into good faith negotiations to reach agreement on reclamation of disturbed areas and payment for damages after, of course, they've drilled or dug or whatever they've done. Although nine other states have established surface owner protection laws, Colorado allows oil and gas companies to enter private property without permission from the landowner, where they can set up industrial equipment, emit air pollution, and occupy acres of private land without negotiating with the landowner. Sounds pretty exciting, doesn't it? Environmental damage incurred by this process has infuriated landowners all over the state and brought together an unusual coalition of homeowners, environmentalists, and farmers. Jared Field of the Colorado Corn Growers Association, a group that strongly supported the bill, describes how such damage has harmed corn crops, corn farms, corn farmers. He says, wastewater from oil wells seeps into an area where we grow our crops, which can interrupt the entire process. Sometimes an oil company will show up during harvest time and place a pump right in the middle of your field with no warning. Such instances are increasingly leading to disputes between farmers and oil companies. They eventually reach the Oil and Gas Commission, which, according to Field, generally favors industry. To back up his claim, Field described one case. Get this, this is just another amazing story. I mean, you just, incredible. Field described one case where an oil company built a pump on the land of two corn farmers in Eaton, Colorado. And then to quote Doug Field, he says, a realtor said the pump decreased their property value by $20,000, but the oil company paid them only $2,000 for the use of their land. When the case went to the Oil and Gas Commission, they said, well, that $2,000 sounds fair to us. Well, you know, you got a Republican administration, what do you expect? The Oil and Gas Commission isn't the only place industry has been able to flex its power. Representative Kathleen Curry, who drafted the Colorado bill, told Bush Green Watch that oil and gas interest groups intensively lobbied state legislators. As Kathleen Curry says, the industry lobby launched a massive email and telephone campaign throughout the state. The industry also called hundreds of constituents in all 11 committee members' districts, telling them that if 1219 passed, their gas bill would immediately skyrocket. Yeah, right. So they're calling up voters saying, if you don't let us take advantage of these landowners, your gas bill is going to go up. Oh, my. Yeah, well, you know, it might. It might go up a penny a cubic foot or something. And you may have farmers still able to keep their farms. Speaking of strange Republican bedfellows, are you familiar with Carr Arms, K-A-H-R? Very German-sounding name, isn't it? Carr Arms. Sounds strong. Teutonic. Well, it's actually a company owned by the son of Reverend Moon. And they're like the leaders in providing a product that has met a market niche. That market niche, and this was something that Reverend Moon's son saw when he was in college. He says, you know, I saw this market niche, and what an opportunity to make some money. And that is for a small, lightweight gun that fires, you know, fairly heavy-duty ammunition. I mean, up until recently, if you had a very small, lightweight pistol, it fired a .22 or, you know, fairly small caliber. But now these are 9mm. And 45s. Carr Arms now has a 45 ACP in its polymer line of compact auto loaders. These are guns, by the way, they have very little metal in them. I'll let you use your imagination as to how that could be used. Well, as Dan Johnson writes in Guns and Ammo magazine, the January issue, he says, perhaps the best news in handguns for 2005 is that we are no longer burdened with the magazine capacity limitations of the so-called assault weapons ban. Some companies, Springfield, for example, began shipping new double-stack handguns with high-capacity magazines the day after the ban expired. Then he goes on to talk about how Car Arms now has a 45 ACP in its polymer line of compact autoloaders. This is sure to be a popular CCW gun, pushing a scant 17 ounces, with slender proportions reportedly only an inch thick in the grip area. Handgunner magazine talks about how car pistols have become the handgun world's greatest success story in the last decade, the Glock of the 90s. Not only has the line expanded with new models and calibers, the company itself has risen like a dot-com stock. Car Arms absorbed Auto Ordnance and now manufactures and sells that company's Thompson submachine guns and generic 1911-A1 pistols. Car was a division of the Saelo Group, pronounced Saelo. The parent company was founded in 1983 by Car Arms founder, the Reverend Sun Myung Moon. Now, you know, this isn't an anti-handgun screed, by the way. I respect people's rights to own and appropriately own and use handguns and hunting rifles, even though I'm a vegetarian. You know, this is life in America. I mean, it's not going to change. And although I do think that there are weapons whose only purpose is to kill other human beings, and there's no reason for those to be in the marketplace. I mean, assault weapons. Obviously, these small handguns, obviously, their only purpose is to kill other human beings. They're being sold for defense and, you know, for better or worse, you know, welcome to America. But the question in my mind, the larger question, as it were, is if you've got a guy who says that he's the reincarnation of Jesus Christ, that Jesus didn't finish his ministry, didn't finish his work, and Reverend Moon has come back to finish his work. He has insinuated himself very, very heavily into the Republican Party, publishing the Washington Times. Just last week, there was an article about how Reverend Moon has said if the Washington Times doesn't start giving him more and better coverage, he may stop publishing. And he's sunk billions, or at least $1 billion, into this thing. He's still losing money. You get Tony Blankley on the McLaughlin Report, you know, every weekend, the McLaughlin Group, which I think is one of the best political commentary talk shows, you know, on the Sunday TV. And there's old Tony, you know, the Ed Mooney, right? I don't know Tony's religion, but you work for Reverend Moon. You work for Reverend Moon. And here's this guy who says that he has come back to finish Jesus' work. And he starts a company that manufactures guns that kill people. I mean, these are not even hunting rifles. I mean, it's not like he's saying, well, you know, this is for the sacrificial lamb or something. You know, it's we're going to sacrifice, you know, sheep or goats or, although they kind of gave that up, you know, with Christianity. But actually, Judaism gave that up with the end of the Second Temple around the time of the beginning of Christianity. But it's like weapons. And now his son is heading up this company. So I no particular loud screed there. Just the strange bedfellows. This is the guy who bailed out Jerry Falwell when Liberty University was going under. This is the guy who was crowned Messiah and King of the World in the United States Senate office building by a member of the United States House of Representatives in the presence of several others. And, you know, Republican Senator John Warner set the thing up. So, I don't know. I just find it fascinating. In the meantime, something that I think is perhaps a larger issue, this six, speaking of messiahs and whatnot, 666. You remember the number 666? Has to do with commerce and beasts and stuff like that. Those of you who have read the Book of Revelations. Well, the trade deficit for the United States, the amount of money that we had to borrow from other countries in order to buy their stuff. It's like if you have an account with the local store. You know, the old days when Festus would go into town and he'd say, hey there, Ralph, I need to buy a pound of flour and 30 boxes of ammo. And okay, Festus, here it is. Shall I put it on your tab? Yeah, put it on the tab. And that's what we've been doing. We've been buying stuff from China and putting it on the tab and selling it at Walmart. Well, the tab this last year was $666 billion. And now the New York Times says there's a consequence to that. I'll tell you about it right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And who's gonna pay the bill? Who's gonna pay the bill?
Well, it's gonna be your children and your grandchildren.
Not Rush Limbaugh, not George Will, not those chicken hawks on Capitol Hill, not the tax cut billionaires. You know the drill. You're gonna pay the bill.
Yeah, you are. Well, actually, we already are. We're gonna this year. We're paying $160 billion in interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed to make the economy look good enough that he could get himself reelected in 1984. In interest on the debt that he ran up, and Dick Cheney has the audacity to say, "Well, Ronald Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter." Well, deficits do matter, and there are three big ones that every American should know about. There is the debt of the United States, the total debt. That's the total money that we owe, you know, what the government spends beyond what it brings in. And it had never before been above $1 trillion. It had never even hit $1 trillion until Ronald Reagan came into office. And Reagan just ran that thing up as hard and as fast as he could. And we are still paying for it, literally. And then W came along and just about doubled it. We're pushing $7.5 trillion now in our national debt. Then there is the amount that you add every year to the debt. That's called the deficit. And the deficit this year is going to be around $600 billion. And you can add about $200 billion to every deficit figure going all the way back to the mid-80s, because Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush all borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund to reduce the apparent deficit. So there's actually a bigger debt than what's showing on the books. And then there's the trade deficit. And that's the amount that the balance of trade between us and the whole rest of the world, the amount of stuff we buy versus the amount of stuff we sell. And if we sell $100 worth of $100 billion worth of stuff and we buy $100 billion worth of stuff, we're in balance. When countries sell more than they buy, they end up getting richer. And we did that for a long time. When Ronald Reagan first came into office, we were the richest nation in the world. But then, you know, free trade policies, most favored nation status, all this, these silly, they're not silly, they're criminal trade policies pushed by the multinational corporations that had brought Reagan into office, and Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. and Bill Clinton, for that matter. NAFTA and GATT and WTO. And these policies now have led us to become bankrupt. $666 billion in 2004. Can you imagine what the right-wing the paranoid fringe of the right wing would do had a Democrat been in office and the trade deficit had come in at 666. Well, the bottom line is we've got to do something about this. I mean, you just can't have this kind of, you know, we're projecting $1 trillion in money that we're going to have to borrow from foreigners next year to cover our trade deficit and our budget deficit. And the time is going to come when they're just not going to loan it to us anymore. Or they've bought so much of America, they don't want to buy any more of it anymore. And we will be totally busted. We've got to get some responsibility in Washington, D.C. Get involved in the political process, learn about this stuff, and vote for reasonable people.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.